KIOS FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS FM on Thursday, June 24, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Today's speakers will be Hugh and Peggy Riley, authors with their late father Bob Riley of the newly published picture coffee table book on the 150-year history of Omaha. The title of their presentation is Omaha, 150 Years, A Historical View. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Willis, member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a noontime forum at the club on issues we think is of interest to our members and the public at large. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend. We welcome the audience here at the Press Club today and our KIOS radio audience. Omaha, 150 years, from its beginning as the eastern point of the origin for the first transcontinental railroad, Omaha has grown into a thriving center for education and industry. As the city prepares for its 150th birthday celebration in July, the Omaha Press Club welcomes Hugh Riley and Peggy Riley to our noon forum. Hugh, Peggy, and their father, Bob Riley, who died recently, wrote a book on the history of Omaha. Copies of this book will be available for purchase and signing after our forum. There's paper also on your table. Please write down any questions that you may have for them, and they'll be brought up to the podium. Hugh and Peggy?
Yes. This is nice. We get to sit down.
I would like to point out that the old man is here with us.
That's right. He's right up there in the corner.
So.
I saw him wink at me when I came in. Well, when we were first approached about this, we were very flattered, and because I know neither Peggy nor myself nor my father would consider ourselves professional historians, we are storytellers. And those of you that were fortunate enough to know my father know that he was a storyteller par excellence. Neither one of us claimed to be there yet, but we're working on it. So when we were asked to do this, actually, Betty Davis, Douglas County Historical Society, approached my father with the 150th anniversary and thought that they would like to produce a picture book, a photo history book. This is it, by the way, and we'll talk about it here, to commemorate the anniversary. And Dad decided he had an awful lot of things on his plate, as he always did, so he recruited both myself and Peggy to help him out with this project. And basically the way we split it up was we had my dad and I basically kind of split the chapters up. Peggy did some of the research for us, and then there was also a section in the back of the book that all these business profiles, and Peggy really was the one who was in charge of that, and I helped her write some of those. But and there was another gentleman named Stan Strubel who also helped with the business profiles. And the early meetings with my father on this book, my dad's the kind of a guy, very organized. He's the kind of guy, he goes away for the weekend, asks you to walk the dog, and he leaves you 3 pages of instructions. So the meetings were detailed and very methodical and well planned out. And so we really had things well in hand when we started the research. We knew what we wanted to do, what we wanted to cover. The big challenge for this was, since it was a photo history book, we wanted the emphasis to be on the photos. Certainly we wanted the text. The text was important, had to be accurate, had to be entertaining, but the photos are going to carry the book, and that was the intention all along. So we were limited to 30,000 words. 30,000 words is not an awful lot to write about 150 years. Or I think my dad has statistics in there somewhere, how many pages per year or something like that, or paragraphs per year. So that was our challenge, and as a consequence, we weren't able to write about everything. I'm sure there was some important stuff we just simply couldn't cover, and we had to make choices all along the way what we wanted to write about and what we wanted to talk about. We certainly covered things in a broad outline and then spent a little more time on specific incidents, and those were judgment calls. Those were things we decided this is an interesting story. We want to talk about this. People may know about this. They may not know about this. We think it's interesting. We want to talk about it, while never really ignoring any of the very important things. We started out with the first chapter was called the Thunderstick Men, Prehistory to 1853. And that basically talked about the Indians, talked about some of the early settlers, some of these things. And I'll just share with you some of the topics that are covered in that section, each of these sections as we go along, and I look forward to answering more specific questions when we finish here. But like so many cities, so many towns and villages, Omaha was really is where it is because of the rivers, principally the Missouri River, but also the Elkhorn River, the Platte River, the Douglas County. This book was not strictly about Omaha alone. It was about Douglas County. But because Omaha dominates Douglas County, most of it naturally was about the history of Omaha. But we tried to include information about other cities in Omaha as well, in Douglas County as well. But the Thunderstick Men, it starts with the Indians. We talked about the Omaha Indians. There were other tribes that were here. The Iowa, the some of the Osage might come up this far north some, from time to time. But there were some interesting individuals in the Omaha tribe. There was a chief named Blackbird. He was here in the late 1700s into the early 1800s, and he was kind of a Machiavellian kind of a guy. He there were traders through here even before Lewis and Clark. Of course, most people think of the first visitors, white visitors to this part of the country were Lewis and Clark. Really, there were people that came through here. The Spanish were supposedly in not in Douglas County, but were in parts of southern Nebraska in the 1500s. An expedition of Spanish came up that far north. At least it's assumed that that happened. There were traders that were through here, French voyagers that came through this area. There were, so they had contact with the Indians. And this Blackbird was an interesting fellow. He's, if you go up to Blair, Nebraska, you see his grave up there, overlooking the Missouri River Valley. And he was not averse to using some of the new technology that was given to him by the white traders, things like arsenic, things like that, to kind of influence the politics of the time. So he was a colorful character. One of the other early influential members of the Omaha tribe was a guy named Logan Fontenelle. You might remember the old Logan Fontenelle. It was in Logan Fontenelle Hotel here, Fontenelle Park. He was the son of a French trader and an Omaha Indian, and so he kind of had one leg in each world, as they say in Native America. He had a leg in the white world and a leg in the Indian world, and was very much a force to try to act as a mediator between the two cultures. He was a brave warrior, fought many battles against some of the hereditary enemies like the Sioux. In fact, again, this is not absolutely certain, but it's thought that he was killed by a Sioux raiding party in the 1840s, I think. I'd have to look that up again. But one of the members of that Sioux raiding party was purported to be Crazy Horse, a young Crazy Horse of the Oglala Sioux on one of his first raids. The Lewis and Clark, of course, were celebrating the 100th anniversary of Lewis and Clark. They came through here in 1804. And if you look in some of you, I'm sure some of you have read their diaries, and you look in their diaries, one of the mentions, a couple of things they mention about this area. They talk about a series of low mounds that they saw that they thought might have been ancient burial mounds of some of the Indians, the prehistoric Indians that were in this area. And they may have just been simply geographical features, but they talk about them in there. And they would have been not too far from here, I think like 14th and Farnham, something like that, so pretty close to here. They also talk about how bad the mosquitoes were here, so some things never change. Some of the early trading posts, we had a man named Manuel Lisa, who came up from St. Louis and established trading posts more in the Bellevue area, but then also kind of moved some up a little bit farther. There was a man named Caban, C-A-B-A-N-N-E, who established a trading post just this side of the Douglas County border, near the Washington County, Douglas County border, and was very successful for a number of years. And, of course, some other early visitors and settlers were the Mormons, who came in 1846 and settled up in what they called winter quarters near what we now call Florence, and were there for several years as kind of a way stop on their way west to Salt Lake City and the Great Salt Lake. So we had a lot of those visitors here, but as you mentioned, the real impetus for the city of Omaha was the railroad. And they first had the riverboats, they first had the trading posts and all those sort of things, but it was the railroad that really made this town take off. And I suppose if you go back to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, was probably when the territory was formed, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, there was controversy about that. Nebraska was a free state. Kansas, there was battles fought between the free staters, the anti-slavery and the pro-slavery folks in Kansas, as you know. Nebraska was fortunately free of all that. There really wasn't a whole lot of that went on up here, partly because there wasn't the population here that they had in Kansas, so it wasn't as much of a problem. But the one of the interesting things, and I see my friend Mike Kelly here scribbling madly, one of the interesting things about the early settlement of this part of the world, and this happened a lot of places, is the newspapers. There were newspapers before there was almost any other business. I happened to do my thesis on newspapers in Nebraska, and of Omaha in particular, but there was a newspaper called the Omaha Arrow that was established here in the early 1850s, only had a few issues. It was actually published in Council Bluffs because there was nothing here. Although he claims to have written the first issue seated on the ground with the paper written on a stump. And so it was officially a Nebraska newspaper, even though it was published in Council Bluffs. But a lot of these early newspapers were associated with ferry companies. And it was an interesting business arrangement because what would happen was the ferry companies wanted to establish settlers because then they would use their services to get across the river and they could make money. And so a lot of them started newspapers. That's really how the Omaha Arrow started. And they talked about, they would sing the praises of these little frontier towns as if they were going to be the next Paris or New York or Chicago. And, of course, many of them didn't turn out to be. But Omaha really fulfilled a lot of the expectations from those early promotional newspapers. Some other very influential people here early on was the Creighton family. The Creightons, Edward and somebody help me out with some of the other names. John, thank you. Edward and John Creighton. And also there was a brother-in-law that were here first, got involved with the telegraph company, and then also invested in the railroads, invested in the stockyards. Of course, Creighton University was founded by the Creighton family. Actually, it was originally a high school for boys. It wasn't until it was 4 or 5 years after it was established that they started having college, but it was originally a high school, a private boys' high school. So all of those people had influence on how Omaha grew and the shapes it took, and of course, the railroad, the Union Pacific Railroad here, we're not too far from the headquarters of Union Pacific, very influential in the development of the town. Without the railroad, it's probably doubtful that Omaha would have grown the way that it has. It became a shipping point to all points west, not just with the cattle, but with grain and with all kinds of other products. So very, very important. One of the other things that we covered in the book, took an incident out of the book because we thought it was interesting. Some of you may have heard about this, the trial of Standing Bear. In the 1870s, mid to late 1870s, in fact, 1878, if I'm not mistaken. And that was held, or is it 1879? 1879, thank you. I knew it was in there. They talked about it in 1878, but they didn't really get to it because it was the court was jammed up, so it was 1879 before they started. No. Traffic jam, yeah. 1879, just the story. How many of you know about Standing Bear? Probably quite a few of you. Standing Bear was a chief of the Ponca tribe. They were located up in the Niobrara River country, and the treaty with the Sioux, actually, the Fort Laramie treaty with the Sioux, there was a little clause in there that said that the Poncas had to vacate their land and give it to the Sioux, their hereditary enemies. And so the Poncas were given a choice of going down to Oklahoma. They were told by the government, go down there, check it out. If you don't like it, you can come back, no problem. Well, they went down there and didn't like it. You know, it was barren, full of rocks. They came back, and the government said, well, too bad, you're moving. And they made them actually, the chiefs actually had to walk back from Oklahoma back up to Niobrara River country. They wouldn't give them transportation back because they refused to agree to move down there. Eventually, they were forced to go down, and in the process, they lost about 30% of their tribe, died within the travels in the first year from sickness and starvation and other problems, including members of Standing Bear's own family, his daughter and his son, 16-year-old son who died and down in Oklahoma, and his dying wish was that he be buried in the land of his fathers. So Standing Bear promised him that he would do that, and in the middle of the night with a handful of followers, he headed north with his son's body to bury him in the Niobrara River country. They kind of took the byways and the off the beaten path and made it all the way back up before they were discovered. General George Crook was the commander of the post here at that time. He was sympathetic to the Indians and particularly to the Poncas, and he thought what was happening was wrong, but he had no way of, he was under orders. He had to send him back to Oklahoma. He had a friend at the Omaha, would have been the Omaha Herald then, and by the name of Thomas J. Tibbles. And Thomas J. Tibbles was a fascinating guy. I could go on about him for quite a while. But anyway, he enlisted Tibbles. He walked from the World Herald area, about where they are now, over to Fort Omaha. It was a Sunday. Met to meet with Standing Bear. Heard about Standing Bear's story and agreed to publicize his story, recruit some lawyers to help him. On the way back from his journey, he stopped at churches along the way, telling people about it, recruiting church members to help him out with this. And the upshot was a couple of prominent Omaha lawyers, Poppleton and who was the other guy? Webster, thank you. Poppleton and Webster, he signed them up to defend him. They used the 14th Amendment, the basically the habeas corpus, saying that if you are a person born in the United States, then you have certain inalienable rights. And Indians, to this point, had not been considered persons. And the upshot of the case was that Judge Dundee declared that, yes, indeed, Standing Bear was a person under the law, so he had the right to stay, would move where he wanted to, do what he wanted to do. And it was an amazing thing on several ways, because it was a frontier town at that time, and this was certainly not something that you would think would happen in a frontier town. And the newspapers, the Omaha Bee, the Omaha Herald, the Omaha Republican, some of the other papers that were around then, all backed this. One of the tragedies of it, however, was that Judge Dundee wrote his law to strictly apply to Standing Bear and his immediate group. Standing Bear had a brother named Big Snake down in Oklahoma who heard about this ruling and said, I'm coming up north too. And with 30 of his followers, he started north. They were captured not too far from the reservation. Big Snake was arrested and was accused of resisting arrest and was bayoneted and killed. So this law case that started off with the father's wish to bury his son in his homeland ended with the death of his brother. So we talk about the case, most people talk about the case and they realize it only applied to Standing Bear, and that really the Indians weren't given citizenship right until 1924, so almost 40 years later, before they were given citizenship rights. Another thing we talk about in the book, interesting thing, many of you have seen photos of the 1898 exhibition, World Exhibition. Incredible, incredible thing. You think about the planning that went into this, and if you see photos of this thing, it's just you can't believe it happened here in Omaha. It was up near in the Florence area. not quite as far north as Florence, but near Florence, where they had a lot of the exhibitions. And they were there was canals, there was palaces. They had an Indian village. Geronimo visited. In fact, there's a funny little story about Geronimo. When he came through, by this time he was an older, he was probably in his 70s or 80s, maybe even older, because they don't really know when he was born. And he had a bit of a drinking problem. He might have had some Irish blood, I'm not sure. But he went on a bender and disappeared. And the newspaper of the time, the Bee, who tended to be kind of a rabble-rousing newspaper, trumpeted these big headlines, you know, murdering savage loose, scalping. You know, this is an 80-year-old man drunk on the side of the road somewhere, and they've got these big headlines about this. And he was found a couple days later, and he was fine and everything. But it was just interesting to see how the media covered things like that. Our next, we talked about from 1901 to 1941 and how the masses moved west. William Jennings Bryan, who was a prominent politician, was a lawyer here in town for a number of years, ran for president twice as a Democratic ticket, lost both times pretty dramatically, traumatic losses. Some of the other things that happened here, many of you may know about the Willie Brown riot, William Brown riot in 1919, but prior to that, in 1909, there was a Greek riot. There was a Greek population, substantial Greek population in South Omaha, and there was a traveling man, a hobo, I guess you would call him, that happened to be of Greek ancestry, who killed a policeman and then continued on his journey. Well, Omahans were incensed about this, and they converged en masse in the Greek settlement in South Omaha, killed a few people, burned down many buildings, and basically destroyed the Greek community down there. And, of course, it was repeated in 1919 with the William Brown case. William Brown was a young to middle-aged black man who was accused of raping a white woman. He had some severe physical disabilities, which probably made it impossible for him to have committed the crime of which he was accused. But nevertheless, he was imprisoned in the Douglas County courthouse area. A mob broke into the prison, tore him out of there, dragged him, hung him, set him on fire, and there's some incredible photos that you can see of the crowd around this burnt body, and they're grinning, and there's young kids in the front row. And the mayor of the town at the time tried to stop him. They strung him up. He was cut down at the last minute by some law enforcement officials. All this happened, you know, not very far from where we're eating lunch right now. And there had been the politics of Omaha at the time was, there was a man named, the mayor had been, for many years had been a guy named Cowboy Bob Dahlman, who was kind of a protege of a guy named Boss Tom Dennison, who kind of ran things. There was a lot of machine politics here then. This William Brown incident actually happened. There was a Reform Party that had been elected, and the mayor of that Reform Party was the mayor when the William Brown incident happened. And ironically, a lot of the things he was trying to improve, this was used against him by Cowboy Bob Dahlman and his party. They said he can't even control the crowds, and the Reform Party only lasted one term. And Cowboy Bob Dahlman got back into office, and Tom Dennison got back into power. There's all kinds of stories about during the 20s about bootlegging and houses of ill repute and secret tunnels under the streets going from offices, and people say those tunnels are still there. I don't know. Some of them maybe. Mike, you've been in those? They're building new ones. That's right. I don't know if it's for the same purpose, but you never know. You never know. We also talked about in the story, we talked about some of the horrendous weather incidents, the tornado, Easter tornado in 1913, which ripped through a lot of these graveyards and tore up a lot of houses. There was actually more deaths in that 1913 tornado than there were in the 1975 tornado, which we also covered. The blizzards, there were some terrible blizzards in the 1800s. Of course, the blizzard of 1975. We talked about Boys Town and the role that Boys Town played in bringing exposure to Omaha. Of course, it's Father Flanagan. I was just in Ireland last week and got a chance to go to Ballymoe, which I had never been to before, where Father Flanagan is from. It was fascinating. There was a busload of 32 people, from most of them from Omaha, and the town turned out with banners and little signs and everything. It was really quite an experience, really quite interesting for us. Other industries developed here, the stockyards, of course. At one point, Omaha had the largest stockyards in the United States, and I think maybe in the world. Of course, that's all gone now, but those of you that grew up here in the 50s and 60s remember the stockyards very well, and earlier, of course. Other big developments, the old market, the 1960s, kind of started with one man's dream. They were going to tear him down, and he thought it would be a great, had great potential and really fought for it and kept things going, and now you see what it is now. You see all this revitalization. I think it's wonderful that Omaha is kind of going back to the river. And our focus on the Quest Center and the new corporate headquarters and all of these things that have sprung up, kind of a return to the river, which that is our single greatest geographical feature. And I think we were mistaken to not take advantage of that. We were to move west without thinking about the geographical benefits of the river. If some of you have been up to the Ponca Hills area, I think that's one of the prettiest neighborhoods in Omaha. Get some of those big, beautiful houses up there overlooking the river, and hardly anybody knows about them. So it's kind of, and the people up there don't want you to know about them. They just as soon keep you in West Omaha. I think the story of Omaha, of course, now it's, as I say, we're moving back to the river to some degree, but it's always been a movement west. I can remember I grew up, and one of the first houses I lived in was a place just west of 72nd and Blondo. And there was a big empty lot behind our house, and there was hardly anything west of us. Now, this would have been in the 1950s, mid to late 1950s, and of course, 72nd and Blondo is almost East Omaha now. You think about Boys Town in the 60s. We'd go out to Boys Town in the 60s, and there was nothing for miles around. There was a little roadhouse out there, 132nd and something, and I know Father Flanagan used to, or Father Hupp used to have to keep the boys out of that roadhouse, probably. But there was nothing. Now you look, now it goes back to 100, and I see they're building a big shopping center, 174th and Pacific or something like that. It's just amazing to me. But we are, as well as moving west, we're also coming back to the river with things, like I said, revitalization of some of the areas down here that we can look out our window and see, and the Quest, the wonderful Quest Center. And the new headquarters, Union Pacific headquarters, ConAgra is down here, all of these wonderful things. So we're kind of returning to our roots. That's a real brief and hurried jaunt through 150 years. I do want to stress some of the things that we had the most fun with in this book. We helped with the selection of the photos. And what we were looking for, we wanted unusual things, you know. There were so many great shots. We had, I don't know how many photos we had, Betty, but I'm sure there were hundreds and hundreds. And most of the photos in the book have never been seen before by the public, a lot of them. I mean, they would be if you wanted to go to Douglas County Historical Society and look them up. But in terms of having been published before, they hadn't been. A lot of them came from private collections. So you've got some wonderful photos of the city when it was in the hills, and they cut out parts of the hills to make room for buildings and roads and things like that. You got some great shots of that, great shots of what is now Central High School, back when it was a territorial capital and all of those sorts of things. But we looked for unusual things. A couple of my favorites I wanted to talk about, and I wish I had an overhead. I could show these to you. But this one is And I know this is Peggy's favorite photo in the book, I think.
Absolutely.
It's called Getting Off the Car, and it's a photo, it's a little poster of a woman getting on a trolley car, and it says, the first little caption, and you're not going to be able to see this, but I'll hold it up anyway. She's here, and she's very demure. She's got this beautiful white dress on, and it says, safe and graceful, and she's getting on the proper way. And then over here, it says, dangerous and awkward, and she's hanging off by her arm, you know, like she's going to fall off. Great photo. And the other one that I really liked was this one here, and this is a woman in a fur standing by the barbershop, and the little sign there says, ladies' necks cleaned, 25 cents. And there's all kinds of great things like that. We've got some wonderful pictures of old, there's some old traveling bands, some great stuff like that. Some of these people, famous people that have visited Omaha through the years, great faces. And those of you that were around, you know, in the 40s and 50s, and you'll see pictures of like the old Chief Theater. I remember the old Chief Theater and a crowd coming out of the Chief Theater in the 1950s. Things like that. The photos, we tried to make them as evocative as we possibly could, because that's really what carries the book. If you want to read an in-depth scholarly history of Omaha, this is not the book. If you want to have a hopefully entertaining, educational history of Omaha that you can read through fairly quickly and enjoy the photos, then this is the book. We certainly did research, but we don't purport this to be a scholarly work in any sense of the word. Still, accurate, entertaining, and we really wanted to use the photos to tell the story as much as possible. We also included a section in this book on the business profiles, and I'm going to let Peggy. I have to tell you that Peggy, how old are you? Can I ask that question?
I'm 39.
She's 39.
For a while now. No.
Yeah, she's 39. And I have to say, this is the long... I've known Peggy, it might surprise you, all 39 of those years. Peggy, I should say, not Peggy. Peggy. And this is the longest I have ever been with Peggy where she wasn't talking. So I'm going to let her talk now.
This is almost the shortest I've ever heard Hugh talk, so...
Peg talked about, did actually manage the business profile section, so I'll let her talk about that.
Since I have a background in technical writing and not so much in the article and magazine writing and book writing that my brother and father did, it seemed that it made sense that the part that interested me was really working with the local businesses. One of the things I really like about the organization of this book is that... in addition to the history, there is a section at the back where businesses who wanted to tell the readers a little bit more about their personal history could purchase space. And when we first started getting these profiles, and I don't think it was really by any particular design, we ended up with just maybe one or maybe two from each individual industry. So we have everything from machine shops to hair salons represented in the book. We have some of the older businesses that you would expect, like First National Bank and people that have been with us for a long time and are really embedded in the history of Omaha. We have businesses that have only been around 5-10 years. So it was, for me, it was very, very interesting. We have someplace in the neighborhood of 50. Is that about right? 50 to 60 in there?
65
that we ended up with. So a really, really big representation. And my brother Hugh and myself and a gentleman from Boys Town, actually named Stan Struble, did the writing of those profiles and got to know. I mean, I'm saving everybody's business cards in case I'm looking for work. That's all I'm saying. Learned a lot about the community. And you could see there is one of the profiles for a business called Neon Products that does signs. And I remember walking into the conference room to begin talking to them. Could absolutely see the evolution of Omaha from their signs. Some of their first signs that were hand-painted, and then as you looked around the room, you would watch the skyline grow, and then there was a period where there was a ton of neon, and then there were city council measures to blocked the neon, so the next picture would be a little bit darker. It was fascinating to me. Thought we could do an entire article, not even talk about the company, just put the pictures of the skyline growing. And I found that really with everybody that we talked to. So as a result, we ended up with a book that's not just about the history of the area, but some great little snapshots of how the industries of the area. We started, as my brother said, with just the railroad, but that's clearly not all that sustains us now. And it was a lot of fun to find out exactly what all that is, but I'll let you read it.
Some of the great stories, too. Like one of the profiles I did was on Hefe and Hefe, and I couldn't include the best stories, but oh, my goodness. I mean, you can imagine. A lot of the historical photos, we asked that if they could, they would include historical photos with their business profile to kind of keep in the theme of the book going. And some of them had some just tremendous historical photos. Hefe and Hefe, I think of, there's a great photo of Count Creighton's funeral cortege, because, of course, they did the funeral going down, I think it's Farnham Street. I'm not sure which street it is. But with the horses and the plumes above the horses' heads and this just long funeral cortege, just some great stuff like that. And I think it made it interesting, rather than, I mean, some of these, that these profiles were not only about the company, but about the history of the company, and so gave you a little more insight, a little more detail into the history of the area, mm-hmm. as Pegeen said. And it was a lot more fun to write them than I thought it was going to be, frankly.
Yeah, I found that too. I thought it would be really dry, and I had so much fun.
Yeah, some of our best stories, and as I said, we can't tell you all of them, but there were some great ones, some great ones.
That's all we have to say. I don't know if you have questions.
Yeah, we have some questions here we'd like to address. The first one is, why did Omaha surpass Council Bluffs in size?
There was more Irishmen here. I think it's because of the river. There was the natural barrier of the river for Council Bluffs, whereas everything was moving west, and we had the ability to move west. Council Bluffs did not. And I think even though the Union Pacific technically started in Council Bluffs, it spread, it took off west. So people thought of the Union Pacific as emanating from Omaha rather than Council Bluffs. So that was part of it. I'm sure it was decisions made by our founding fathers along the way that were wise and judicious that helped Omaha grow. And maybe the city fathers of Council Bluffs weren't as blessed. I don't know. Council Bluffs are doing well now, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. What surprised you most about what you learned? I'm going to guess this is, you know, pertaining to the knowledge that you gathered in, you know, for your book.
Do you want to answer that, or do you want me to answer that?
I don't know what surprised me most. It was endlessly surprising. I don't know. Do you have a particular thing that springs to mind?
There's a lot of stuff. I mean, I had known about the William Brown riots for a long, long time, but I never knew about the Greek riots.
That's true, yeah.
There was a lot of things like that that I discovered. I've studied particularly Native American history. It's always been kind of an avocation of mine, but I learned things about the Omaha Indians, Chief Blackbird in particular, that I never knew. So there was a lot of that, little things. And probably the thing that surprised me most, though, was maybe in the research on the businesses. When we were writing about the businesses, the business profiles, and some of the things you found out about some of these businesses that you've kind of taken for granted all these years and how they got started. And I go back to Hefe and Hefe, which were a couple of brothers from Ireland, and how they came to this country in the first place, and, you know, some of their early struggles, and I mean, just stuff like that was very entertaining and interesting.
Okay. Was Omaha known as a bawdy town in its early years?
There's a wonderful book called, I think it's called A Dirty Wicked Town.
Yeah.
Dirty Wicked Town. If you get a chance to pick that up. It's a great book, and it talks about a lot of this kind of stuff. And absolutely, Omaha was definitely a bawdy town. I mean, I remember growing up here, we always thought of Council Bluffs, you know. Council Bluffs in the 60s and 70s were the ones that had the strip joints and the bars right by the border and all that kind of stuff. But Omaha, really probably until the 19, I don't know when it changed, but I'm guessing 1940s or something, when Cowboy Bob Dennis, or Cowboy Bob Dahlman and Boss Dennison ran things. And this was a real interesting town. There was a lot of action. You could get just about anything you wanted.
But it's well organized. I remember one of the stories I came across when I was doing some research was that there was a representative from the mob back east who got word that there's a lot happening in Omaha, and they sent an emissary out here to kind of see if they could cut in on the action. And Dennison had a couple of people meet him at the railway station, take him around town, escort him, kind of just showing exactly how well organized it was and how difficult it would be to break in, walked him back to the train station, put him on the train, and they never came back. So
there's also a great story about there's a little cemetery on State Street and Mormon Bridge Road, kind of a potter's field there. And one of the people buried there, and I can't think of her name, she was an early madam and very influential, as she ran several houses in Omaha. And Anna Wilson, thank you very much, Mr. Kelly. Anna Wilson. Anna Wilson is quite a story. And you could write
up with that name pretty quickly there, Mike.
She was an amazing woman. And she, during the influenza epidemic in 1919, she selflessly nursed many people back to health when it was considered very, very dangerous to do that because you could have caught the strain itself. When she died, she was a very wealthy woman. She left her estate to the city, and yet she's buried in Potter's Field out there. She's buried in Prospect Hill. Okay, yeah. Maybe it's her paramour that's buried in Potter's Field. Okay. Yes, laid to rest. Finally. But anyway, there's all kinds of little stories like that that make it interesting. I think it's like the title of that book, it's A Dirty Wicked Town. Those are the things that make it interesting to read. You don't want to just read about, I mean, it's fine to read about all the monuments to the generals and all that kind of stuff and the civic leaders, but it's also fun to read about the pimps and the prostitutes and the bootleggers and all that kind of stuff, too.
Okay. Wasn't the river seen as simply a place to dispose of unwanted material for many years?
I don't know what time period that questioner is talking about. The river was the lifeline initially. I do think that there was a time when we grew away from the river, when it was downtown was, I mean, I can remember when Brandeis closed and, there was nothing down here. It was the old market and not even that really for probably a decade. It was really before it got going. And I remember coming down and shopping with my grandma at Brandeis and going to my father's movie, Red Hugh, Prince of Donegal, was premiered at the Old State Theater. And I remember that night so vividly. So all of those wonderful memories of downtown. And then for a couple decades, it kind of went away. And we started thinking about the river. Maybe it was just a place where we dumped things. But that's changed now, thankfully. And I think the river's cleaning up, and we're getting back to the use. We're getting back to a good use of it.
Okay. Since Omaha's 150th birthday is imminent, and since Omaha's last two slogans, "Rarely Well Done" and "Zero," were major embarrassments, do you think there is any chance Omaha could get a real slogan for its birthday?
That's a good question. You know, there have been some good ones in the past. There was...
It was actually O, not zero, which is kind of...
The big O, yeah. Well, I remember there was one that was O, Oma, Aha.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that Omaha struggles with, or has struggled with, is that we don't necessarily have a bad rep, we just don't have a rep.
Yeah,
that's changing a little bit with, I think, greater attention being paid to things like the College World Series and other things that we're doing. That's changing a little bit. But I'm sure there's some, I know there's some very creative advertising folks in this town that could come up with something better than rare, well done. That was obviously done by somebody from out of town. Omaha Steaks are thinking, well, you know, anyway.
Okay. Please add your voices to the argument. Is Omaha or Council Bluffs the eastern terminal of the Union Pacific Railroad?
Who asked that question? Is Bill Ramsey here? I think there's two answers to that question, actually. It depends on what the definition of is one. Technically, Council Bluffs is. Yeah. I think practically, Omaha is. Was that a politically correct answer?
Yeah, actually.
Okay. Other than here at today's luncheon, where is your book available?
From the Douglas County Historical
Society.
That's
right, from the Douglas County Historical Society. It was available at the Borders on 72nd and Dodge.
And the Bookworm at UNO, I think.
Yeah, it's available at UNO for sure, and it's available at the Bookworm for sure, I think. I don't know if Borders has it anymore. You can order it online, but the best place to get it is the Douglas County Historical Society.
Absolutely.
Next question. How many photos are in the book? Do they all come from the Historical Society of Douglas County?
I got them. There are a lot of photos in the book. There's
53,
there's
gotta
be.
No, I don't know.
I think it was over 200, yeah? Before we even got to the profiles.
The profile photos would not be part of the Douglas County Historical Society archives. But the photos that we did include from the archives are just a fraction of the photos that are available.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody asked that question earlier, what was the most surprising thing? I have to recant. The most surprising thing for me was the photos. How many wonderful, incredible photos there were that existed. And that, yeah, I would have to say, thinking about it, that would be the most surprising thing for me in doing this book.
Was there an early godfather in Omaha or a boss that controlled the city?
Dennison.
Yes. Tom Dennison.
Old man, yeah.
Interesting character. In fact, I think his house still exists out on like 72nd Street and Military in that area. Yeah, still there, Skyline Manor, yeah. There's a great photo in there of Dennison with his young bride, who's about
17.
Yeah, and he's probably like 60 or something at the time. And this is before Viagra, remember? So that's even more impressive. But it's a kind of a haunting. You look at this guy's face, and you look at his eyes, and you think, boy, there's a guy that you don't want to mess with. You don't want to cross this guy. Even at that age, I mean, he was in his 60s probably anyway. Very interesting guy. I don't know if there's ever been a book written about him, but there should be.
Sure.
Orv Menard wrote a book about him. That's
Dr.
right.
Menard, yeah.
That's right. Orv Menard, who is a professor at UNO.
Okay, thank you. We'd like to thank everyone for their attendance today. And we'd like to thank you and Pagin for participating and giving us some valuable information.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Somebody had asked earlier about the books, too. I know Betty did bring some books with her. She's got some outside, so if you're interested, we'd be happy to stick around and sign them for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank everyone for their attendance. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest speakers were Hugh and Pagin Riley, co-authors of a newly published pictorial history of Omaha. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, June 24th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, July 22nd at 12 noon. The speaker will be Darrell Draper in a portrayal of Lewis and Clark Expedition frontiersman George Douillard. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.